another special Friday night edition of the pod. I am very glad that we waited to record until tonight. Another just classic, brutal prize fight of a game between OKC and Utah. Utah ends up winning it 96-91 and taking the series, staving off a frantic, and I do mean frantic, OKC comeback. Lots of places to start with this one. I think we do want to start about that call on Paul George, where he got Rudy Gobert in the air, appeared to draw contact on a three-point foul or three-point shot for a three-shot foul with OKC down by three, and no call was made. I was absolutely shocked by that. Did you feel similarly?
I did. And when you consider where the thresholds usually are on those plays, this was well within the bounds that are not only normally called, but almost always called. And the explanation after the game from Rod Gerritsen meeting with friend of the show, Fred Katz of the Norman Transcript, he said, and this is the quote, "Rudy Gobert jumped to the right of Paul George. Our determination was Rudy would not have made contact with Paul had he," meaning Paul George, "not jumped sideways into Gobert's legal space. We determined it to be a non-call."
And if in fact that were what had happened, I completely support that, right? We were railing against Kevin Love having gotten a couple of those calls in the last month or so where he takes a big giant step to his right. And I will admit, the camera angles that I have seen so far, you can't really see that, but I didn't perceive a big step to the right. Gerritsen's response acknowledged that there was contact. I think that that was very, very clear. You know, the ones that we've seen with Love, he's been in the right corner. It's lined up. You can see him take that big step to the right. We didn't have a perfect angle for that on George, but it looked like a pretty normal shot to me, that he wasn't that far outside of the cone of his normal body in live action. Again, we didn't have the angle necessarily to see a step to the right, but I was shocked it didn't happen. We had the sound off, which is what we always do for the Twitter NBA show, and I called it as a foul on the screen. I thought it was just so obvious, and then no, they didn't call it, and then OKC had a bunch of plays where it looked like they had fouled the Jazz, and they didn't actually end up fouling until 6 seconds remained. I think they were just also so disengaged because they were shocked that it wasn't a foul. But I mean, I said on the show, I thought that I generally hate calls like that. That one looked like it was really obvious to me. And of all the calls that are called on that, the get guy in the air and pump fake, I thought that that was like in the 90th percentile of ones that deserve to be a foul.
You know who else it looked like believed it was a foul? Quinn Snyder. I mean, the seeing, especially on the more distant replay, Snyder just go put his head in his hands and just walk as the ball's in the air, not realizing that they didn't call a foul because it looked that way. And I mean, that could also be just that Gobert bit as hard as he did and all that kind of stuff. But I don't want that. Well, so let's talk about what would have happened just briefly if that foul had been called. So Paul George shot that with about 18 seconds to go. OKC was down three. So if he makes all three free throws, then Utah has the ball with timeouts if they were. Directly, they want to drop a play, and they would have a tie game. And so any shot, as long as they did it properly, any shot that went in would win them the game, and a miss would go to overtime. George could have also missed one or more of those free throws. That was one of the through lines of this game, was missed free throws. George only got to the line for two and was split those, so that's not really necessarily predictive one way or the other. He did have tired legs. He played 45 minutes in the game, so it's not like this was swung a win to a loss, but it certainly took it from a much higher chance of a win to an almost guaranteed loss.
Yeah. No, I mean, probably after that miss, their win percentage probably goes down to like, you know, under 5%. And I'm looking at the overhead view of it now, and George did take a little bit of a step to his right. This was actually on the Fox Sports Oklahoma broadcast, so I didn't get a look at this one. But no, I thought, I think looking even at that, George took a step that was about 4 inches to his right, and he attempted to lean his shoulder in a little bit, but I think Gobert, there's no way Gobert doesn't make contact with him even if he goes straight up on that play. George's momentum also is already going to his right as well when he pulls up, which is another part of it with the pump fake. So yeah, I think it was definitely a missed call to me. It was a surprising one, but you know, this probably took the Thunder win percentage when you consider the chance of him missing one of those free throws, which, you know, if he's an 85% free throw shooter, there's still a pretty substantial chance that he misses one of those, and then even then you only got a 50% win percentage. So I mean, that foul probably cost him about, you know, a 15% chance of winning the game ultimately, maybe 20% chance if you really go through and game it out. So it's not as big of a deal. And I certainly would have made the Jazz favorites in overtime, except for Mitchell's five fouls. That's probably the one thing that, but obviously the Jazz were the fresher team by this point and had more depth, and the Thunder were just living on Russell Westbrook hopes and prayers. But that's enough on that call. Let's talk about the meat of the game itself. And I said this during the show, I got a lot of shit from Philly fans about how it was just so obvious that Ben Simmons had a better season. I'm just a moron for even thinking of that Donovan Mitchell could be the rookie of the year. I said it was extremely close. I ended up going with Mitchell. I believe that Mitchell is the slightly better prospect than Simmons. And obviously it's a regular season award, but to watch what he has done in this series and say that it's not a close case, like Ben Simmons could not be doing the things that Donovan Mitchell is doing. There's some things that Simmons does that Mitchell couldn't be doing either. But Donovan Mitchell guarded Russell Westbrook for a great many of his 43 shot attempts in regulation in this series.
In this game, I should just clarify.
Yes, thank
that
you. Sorry.
I'll give this stat because I looked it up. Not only Ben Golver had tweeted out that this was tied with Russell Westbrook for the most shots by an active player in a playoff game, but Per Basketball Reference, it was tied for the third most ever in their database for a playoff game, the two higher being Michael Jordan attempted 45 in a game against Cleveland in 1988, and then Rick Barry has the record, attempted 48 shots against the Philadelphia 76ers in the 67 final.
Yeah, and that's in regulation, I assume?
Yeah, I believe both of those games did not go to overtime.
Because Jordan had 44 shots in game three of the 93 finals against the Suns too, but that was a triple overtime affair. But Mitchell, I mean, to have guarded Russell Westbrook on those shots, we'll talk about Westbrook's performance in a second here, and then to play 40 minutes of his own, 14 of 26 from the field, 38 points, 5 of 8 from 3, he made his first 5 three-pointers, 5 of 5 from the foul line, did have 5 turnovers, but with that level of usage, that's not awful, and just the shots that he made in that third quarter when I think he scored 20 points, he just was killing the Thunder switching defense. And it was so interesting, Danny, I mean, we talked about this too, you said the Jazz were in big trouble when they were down 35-26 because it looked like they had zero traction against OKC's switching defense. Like they weren't even coming close to getting good shots. And then all of a sudden, everything changed for them.
Yeah, and it changed originally in a different way. They were able to get a couple looks in transition, including a big Joe Ingles corner three, got to the free throw line a couple times, including an over-the-back breaker. I believe Derek Favors drew the foul. I'm trying to remember who it was. Derek Favors, who also shot 1-for-7 from the free throw line in this game. But Donovan Mitchell, in that third quarter, I mean, 22 points, 4-of-5 in the restricted area, 3-of-3 from three, and then he was only other two, he split his two other shots, so it was mostly done in those areas, but also got to the free throw line for 3 free throws, which he actually made, which was a rarity in this game, and he was creating a lot of the other looks for his fellow Jazzmen, and it was incredible to see that happen. And on a lot of these possessions, you know, they were starting with Paul George on Mitchell, and that wasn't necessarily where it finished because of switches and everything else, but Utah had gotten so little early in that game, especially once Carmelo left the game, and Mitchell was central. I mean, he's the reason, really, that this turnaround for the Jazz, and they almost scored as many points in the third quarter, 37, as they scored in the entire first half, which was 41.
And to me, Donovan did not start, of course, with the switching scheme, right? And I think maybe a little of that was just to kind of dummy it out, thinking that the Jazz would be ready for it. And they got beat up a little bit early. Rubio had another great pass to Gobert for an easy lefty layup, and then Rubio suffered a recurrence with his hamstring, which has been giving him trouble for quite some time here. You remember he missed the game, went back and played really well in that game in Minnesota, then he missed games again, came back. Hamstrings can obviously be very tricky, and his availability for game one has got to be in question now in the Houston series with a quick turnaround there, and especially because he just got ruled out of the game immediately, essentially. And so Donovan, when he took Carmelo out of the game, brought in Grant, and they went right back to the switching scheme, and all of a sudden the Jazz just could not score to save their lives. They went on a nice little run, end of the first, start of the second, and then when the Thunder brought their guys back in, Westbrook, Adams, etc., it was back up to 35-26, like I mentioned, and I was really disappointed in Snyder because I thought, oh, they're gonna like have some stuff ready, right? They're gonna slip screens, they're gonna have some more action, some more plays that are designed to take advantage of a switching team. We didn't see any of that. It was all just trying to go one-on-one. Mitchell was struggling. Everybody else was doing even worse. And then all of a sudden, and part of this was because Carmelo came back in the game, it just clicked for them. One of the things they were doing was Derek Favors Favors, who is being guarded, of course, by Carmelo, coming up, pretending to set a screen, and then just rolling right to the basket. And Carmelo, you're not really supposed to switch until there's an actual screen set and there's contact. And so Favors was just running up and then running away, and Carmelo was basically double teaming the ball, and they could throw it right to Favors, and then they had the 4-on-3, and Favors was right at the rim on a lot of those plays. So they started getting going that way. They started bringing guys off of screens to the weak side. I think it was Alec Burks who hit a huge three on Westbrook. I think that might have been in the second half, but this is some of the stuff that they were doing where he just sprinted to the opposite side of the floor and Westbrook turned his head. Burks gave them just enough minutes here because, of course, Rubio was out. He gave him some nice penetration at times that they desperately needed. He was able to go at Carmelo as well. And I mean, every action, it seemed like, as Mitchell got going at the end of the second quarter, and then he scored, I think, their first 12 points for the Jazz in the third as they got up to a 10-point lead immediately after halftime, essentially. That was all, not all, but a lot of it in actions involving Carmelo just on the switch, him just kind of double teaming, not really switching the way he was supposed to. And as it turned out, Carmelo finished the game negative 19 in 26 minutes, 7 points, 3 of 7 from the field.
And as is so often the case, when it comes down to it, and a team, and this is different when a team is coming from behind, or when they're behind, because then you need to go differently, you see what a coach actually thinks is best. And Melo was not on the floor. Corey Brewer was not on the floor. Jeremy Grant, not a surprise. I thought Jeremy Grant was very impactful defensively. Also had a couple of surprising scores in this game, including a corner three that I personally thought Jay Crowder should have closed out better on. But the more surprising of those two subs was that it wasn't Alex Abrines, who had been so central in game five. It was Raymond Felton. And why Raymond Felton bothered me in that spot was you do not need his shot creation. Russell Westbrook is creating and taking almost every shot. The other ones are created and taken by Paul George. Felton, not as versatile defensively, and it's not like he's a better shooter than Abrines. So I didn't think Felton made a ton of sense in that lineup. I do not think that's why OKC lost this game. And I do think that having Melo out was more important than the Felton-Abrines difference. I just found it interesting.
Yeah, that was a little odd. And I'd love to get to the end of the game, but a few other things I want to discuss in the beginning here. Late in the second, as the Jazz got back into it, Adams got his third foul on, I thought, a really bad call. Derek Favors had inside position on him. Scott Foster called it from behind Adams and called Adams with a push, but he would have had to have had x-ray vision to see through Adams' body to see if he had shoved Derek Favors. And then Favors had reached around behind him and grabbed Adams' jersey on the play. If anything, it should have been a foul on Favors. That ended up being a big problem as Adams had to go out of the game. And then Jeremy Grant had a massive lefty block of Favors that just was somehow called a foul. And so he had to go out with three fouls as well. So they had to go back to Carmelo and Patrick Patterson. And that was a big part in the Jazz getting back into it right at the end of the half, tying the game at 41. I want to talk a little bit just about how Mitchell was doing what he was doing. Like, his finishing has just been an absolute revelation. Like, he sucked as a finisher in college. Like, and some of the articles have been written about him, how he's able to just internalize stuff that they show him immediately. I mean, that's clearly true. Even this season, right? Like, finishing off of 1 foot. You know, he came down for a big dunk in game five off of 1 foot. In this game, he's able to just accelerate so quickly and not necessarily jump that high off 1 foot, but he can get extension. His extension is unbelievable. He had a move that I never see NBA players do. That's actually more common in women's basketball, where you do an up and under and then you step through and lift your back foot off the ground so you can get way more extension almost into a layup. And that's not a travel. You lift that foot off the ground and take a step forward, but you're not actually traveling because that right foot never comes down again. You know, it's basically you're jumping, but you're jumping 1 foot at a time. And women's basketball happens all the time. Nobody in the NBA uses that, which is a shame because you could cover so much ground on that move with the athletes. But he did that move. You know, I've basically never seen an NBA player do that move.
I'm shocked you didn't mention the scoop shots.
Well, yeah, that was because he's got the best scoop shots in the NBA right now. I mean, as a rookie, it's incredible. And he didn't even have that in his arsenal a year ago. And going left, going right, he missed a shot. He got an unbelievable lefty tip in as well of his own miss. Like, he was just relentless. And he was all that Utah had in the fourth as OKC pushed it to even more of just a ridiculous fever pitch. And the level of physicality of this game as we went into the fourth quarter, you know, it looked like the Jazz were going to walk away with this, even as Russell Westbrook had his own unbelievable third quarter to keep pace with Mitchell to some degree. Jazz led it by 13 with 7 minutes left in the game. And then OKC somehow made a final push on the back of Westbrook.
Yeah, I want to go through a couple of the stats from Westbrook. So in the third quarter alone, he had 20 points, 7 of 15 from the field, a huge 4 of 8 from 3. He was just so confident with his shot at that point, and he knew that he needed to do it. Then in the fourth quarter, played the whole time, another 11 points on 4 of 14 from the field, had a little bit of trouble late, which, I mean, as the game got closer, it could have really swung it. Not that I'm blaming him at all. It's just, you know, that's a couple more shots fall. It's different. And it's just incredible how he is willing and able to take on these massive workloads in terms of shot creation, because he's creating all of these shots other than a couple of botched covers. There was one where Jay Crowder and Derek Favors both lost him or never had him going to the three-point line. But other than that, they were pretty much all created by Russell Westbrook, and he did a lot of making shots for other people, including the couple of baskets Steven Adams got.
Yeah, Westbrook, when they went down 86-73, made a 16-footer. Jeremy Grant, off an offensive rebound from Steven Adams, hits his own three-pointer right off after his own missed three-pointer. This is right after they went to Raymond Felton, by the way. This is 7 minutes left. Felton enters the game for Brewer. They never go back to Melo, of course. After that, there's a timeout. Westbrook, off a rebound, sprints down, gets a dunk. Jay Crowder fouls him, and all of a sudden, a 13-point game goes to 5 in basically a minute and a half. That's when Mitchell had that huge tip shot after that to put the Jazz back up 7, and Rudy Gobert had a layup to make it 9, and then the Thunder were able to get back again, but just they even got back within 1 on another ridiculous Westbrook 3-pointer. But then I think this was the key shot of the game to me. Mitchell is trapped on the side. Gobert is like trying to post up, and off of a switch, they're swarming Mitchell, and Derek Favors, who has worked so hard on his mid-ranger, but one of the worst mid-range shooters in the NBA this year, he'd been better at it in previous years, sprints to the foul line and gets the jump shot because his man Grant was a little bit worried about the drive from the pick and roll on the side, and hits that J to put them up 3. And we wouldn't need to quite do possession by possession here, but let me just read to you the play-by-play. Russell Westbrook misses driving layup. Steven Adams offensive rebound. This is all with Thunder down 3. Paul George misses 29-foot three-point jumper. Russell Westbrook offensive rebound. Russell Westbrook misses 30-foot three-point jumper. Raymond Felton offensive rebound. And then Billy Donovan got a timeout with 37.9 left. That was actually their last timeout, but it felt like it was just so frantic that I totally understand why it was that he called it. And then they got George that... Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, there were two other offensive rebounds between them and the George shot.
No, there's one more. George drove on Gobert, and I thought actually that Gobert may have fouled him on that play too. George went up. Gobert was on the ground but had his arms forward. I thought there was contact on the arm of George. He missed the layup. Gobert, again, was just massive around the rim in this game. Steven Adams gets the offensive rebound. Westbrook misses a 30-footer, and then they get another offensive rebound on what it was initially called a jump ball, but Grant knocked it out of Mitchell's hands, and it went off of Mitchell barely, and they gave the ball to the Thunder again. Yeah, I'd forgotten that happened. And then they put Carmelo in at the end, and that it was 18 seconds left when George missed that three-pointer. I think I said it was like a little earlier than that.
Yeah, it was an absolutely insane, frantic ending, and the Thunder made so many chances. They ended up not converting those. It can happen. It's basketball. That's the way it goes. But an absolutely just incredible game that had so many different facets to it, because you had that long stretch where it looked like, you know, early on, I thought Utah was humming. Ricky Rubio goes out with the injury, and then yeah. You're like, oh, how are they going to figure this out?
And they started switching everything. And you're like, they just have no chance. They have no plan. They have no chance against this Thunder length and the switching. And then all of a sudden, they just like start killing them. They put up 37 in the third. Just so unexpected.
And it also tied in with another theme from this series, where what was so weird about it, why I thought the Jazz didn't have a chance, was because I thought anything they had on the sort of switching defense would have been generated based on game 5. That was key in the collapse. And then when they didn't have an answer, you're like, oh, well, they just don't have one. And then going to Favors slipping the screen, going to a couple of the other approaches in the second half really did open things up. And the Jazz offense looked different. It looked more coherent there. So credit to Quinn Snyder and the coaching staff. I mean, that's a full coaching staff effort to get stuff, but that's why I felt the way that I did. Second time I made a big pronouncement in this series, both of which were wrong. One was saying that OKC was done when they were down 25 in game 5, and then saying Utah was in big trouble when they ended up coming back. But the process behind both of those was these teams had faced that same problem before and didn't appear to have fixed it. And then for whatever reason, after that happens, they actually go to the thing that worked.
Yeah, and again, I think just targeting Melo more was awesome. Another thing, too, while Rubio, you know, has been pretty good in this series, they did go to Donovan Mitchell at point guard, and they were really helped by the fact that Favors and Gobert was their best front court, because now that pushed everyone down. You could play Crowder at the three. You had Ingles, who played 42 minutes in this one, 3 of 6 from three, including a beautiful step back. They went to Royce O'Neal. They had Burks, but because they wanted to play Favors and Gobert together, that gave them more wings to put into the rotation. And we saw, for those who kind of doubt that Donovan Mitchell's best position might be point guard, I'm not sure if there are that many of those doubters. I've been saying it should be that for a long time, especially because of what you can do defensively to get more size on the floor. And he did all of what he was doing at point guard, and they had a little more shooting on the floor than they would normally have with Rubio, and just putting it in Mitchell's hands every time I thought it was fantastic. And he basically was the guy who won in this game, along with Gobert, who what did the Thunder shoot at the rim in this game? It can't have been good.
So the final line was they ended up 13 of 22 in the restricted area, and then another 6 of 16 in floater range.
Yeah, and only 2 shooting fouls on plays at the rim as well. And the bigger thing than the percentage, which is not an amazing one, is the 22 shots at the rim. That's basically, for a Thunder team that has Russell Westbrook, Steven Adams on the offensive glass, Grant a good finisher, to only get 22 shots at the rim. I mean, that's just the Gobert and the Favors effect too. Favors had some massive blocks in this game. When you play those two guys together, if you can't space those guys out, you're going to just have massive problems scoring. And really what ended up happening with Paul George having a miserable game, he was 2 of 16. One of them was a massive dunk that he uncorked at the rim. And I can't even remember what his other make was, maybe a mid-ranger or something. But with him going so poorly, and Westbrook, to me, he had no choice but to take all those shots, right? I mean, those 43 shots, like, who else was going to do it? He had it going reasonably well. And if the Thunder D could have just held up a little bit more the way it had in the first two games, the way it had down the end of game five, then all of a sudden, you know, this Westbrook strategy would have been enough to bring them home, but they just couldn't quite be efficient enough defensively. And you're only, while, you know, Bill Simmons had this point of, you know, teams can't win playing this way with this many shots. And you're right. I mean, unless you just have an unbelievable defense, there's just no way one person can shoot 43 shots, especially with so many of them jumpers, so many of them with the Favors and Gobert on the floor, and have you be a really efficient offense. I mean, it's like, even when he got hot from three, it was like, you know, he's going to shoot so many shots that it has to regress to the mean. There's no way that you can be that hot over that many shots and make, you know, well over 50% of your threes or over 50% of your twos. And that's what ended up happening. And the Jazz offense just gave them enough points, especially in that third quarter. I think that's really what OKC will look back on.
Something else, we've alluded to it, but I think we should be more outright of it. Paul George was massive in game one. I think it was a big part of why they won that game. Yeah. And defensively, I thought he had a very good series overall, but he just couldn't find the stroke in this game. 2 of 16 from the field, missed all 6 of his threes, got to the line for just 2 shots and split those. He did have 8 assists, but also had 6 turnovers, and a couple of his turnovers were of the head-scratching variety, like weird passes.
One just like went through his hand, you know, like just out on the perimeter, 40 feet from the basket, just a totally normal pass.
Well, and then I think somebody just ripped him once, like he was just dribbling the ball and just it got taken from him. And George, not the greatest ball handler in the world. I mean, I don't think that has to be a strength for a player who's not your primary ball handler. It's certainly useful. We've seen that from all over the court, but he just didn't have it today. And another surprising kind of part of this game, I talked about Raymond Felton a little bit, you know, that he played, but also going to Josh Huestis and Patrick Patterson not playing at all. Like, I understand that on the switch system, Patterson has some limitations, but having another player, especially with the way that Patterson freaked out Gobert a couple of times earlier in the series, I just think that could have opened things up a little bit for the other guys on the team.
No, I think that's right. I thought that Patterson, his jumper actually looked okay to me in series. But yeah, and you know, the drama now in OKC will start, right? Carmelo Anthony cannot be happy about having played this few minutes in this closeout game. And after, obviously, you know, Donovan listened to him and they came through, I think, in spite of him in game five with the comeback. And this time he finally just didn't play him, but maybe even played him too much. You know, but I don't think it was ever realistic that he was going to play fewer than 26 minutes. That's what he played in this one. But I mean, the negative 19, it just killed him. He's getting killed every time on defense. And at some point you have to say to a player, hey, you're not giving me enough offensively for what you're doing on defense. And I know Carmelo Anthony is a really respected guy around the league, very connected. Not the kind of guy you want to piss off. He waived his no trade clause to come to OKC. This is not what he envisioned. But I mean, someday you got to win the fucking game, man. Like, and Donovan just did not quite have the balls to do it. You know, I'm sure that this was probably a discussion that he even had with management at various times this year, and especially now. And that really killed them. And if they could have gotten back at home game seven, they probably would have been big favorites. But I thought they're massively outplayed by Utah in the series. And if Westbrook and George at the same time just couldn't give them these unbelievable efforts, you know, and worth noting, Westbrook had two good games in the series. George had two good games in the series, and they won two games in the series. Although Westbrook's other good one was tonight. So this was clearly a massively flawed team. They weren't that good. Utah was fantastic. They won without their starting point guard in this game, and they'll be moving on to play against the Houston Rockets. Would you like to do a prediction for that series?
Just quickly before that, story of this game, another piece. I thought Steven Adams played really well.
8 offensive
battling. A nice touch on his floater, something we've talked about all season. And I thought he contested well. And early on, he was taking advantage of Gobert being very afraid of committing fouls. Gobert ended this game with just one personal foul. And so he was attacking, got a couple finishes, including an alley-oop, one-handed alley-oop catch and dunk. And so I wanted to just make sure we get shouted out Steven Adams because I thought he did a really nice job in this game.
Yes, thank you for doing that. I meant to, and I forgot about it. So this series against Houston, Jazz on a very quick turnaround. What is your prediction? You can go first on this one. We'll do the Pels. Actually, so we can do Pels Warriors like right after this because we don't really have a natural lead in for that other than this.
Okay. I picked Utah because of this idea of styles makes fights. And I thought that the way OKC plays tied in too much with what Utah's strengths were. I feel that same thing in this series, except that it's Utah into Houston's hands. And what I mean by that is we saw in this series that Utah, other than Donovan Mitchell, and we don't know Ricky Rubio's availability in this upcoming series. We have basically the same information anybody else.
Well, can I make a guess? And I think he's going to miss at least the first game. I agree with you. I mean, playing, he couldn't continue in this game. You know he would have if it were even remotely possible. When it's not even remotely possible, here's an analog for you, right? Chris Paul, game 7, 2015 against the Spurs. You remember that he hit that heroic shot, but he messed up his hamstring, and then he actually missed the next two games, but he was even able to play on. Now, Chris Paul on that team on one leg versus Ricky Rubio on this team on one leg, and whether you're hurting the team, you know, difficult to say. Rubio is clearly unable to move, and if a hamstring injury is that bad, it's rare that it's going to be less than a week before you come back. So my prediction, he's going to miss at least game one, especially with the quick turnaround, especially with the flight, which definitely doesn't help you heal. And I think he could well miss game two also. So that's my prediction. I think he comes back in game three most likely.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable timeline with this. And so I do think that Utah's defense is for real. I think they can, you know, they can make life hard on Houston, but I think Utah's offense is going to be the big story. Donovan Mitchell will have some nice games. So I was vacillating between, I think on talent and fit and all that, I would be going towards Houston in six. But because of the uncertainty of the Rubio injury, also the idea that Houston, I think, they'll just have some hot offensive games there. They'll get into that cycle. And I'm going to go Houston in five. And this is another one of those. I'm not tactically thinking about this. If I were going at like our competition, even though we haven't ironed out the scoring yet, I'd probably go Houston in six. But I'm going to go with what I think is the most likely outcome. And so Houston in five.
I will go there as well. But I want to talk a little bit more about the matchup. We saw what OKC's switching when they weren't just like screwing it up or when they didn't have Carmelo Anthony involved was able to do to the Utah Jazz. Now is a team that may even have surpassed Golden State, because Golden State doesn't play this way all the time, as the best switching team in the NBA. And they can switch 1 through 5. They love to switch 1 through 5. Especially, they also played against a team in the Wolves that plays two bigs. We'll see whether Utah can get away with that. But without Rubio, it becomes a lot harder with one fewer player in your wing rotation. I think that Utah is really going to struggle to score in this series. It's going to take more Herculean effort from Donovan Mitchell one-on-one, and maybe they'll try and get Harden out in the perimeter on Mitchell. I hope that they do, because I think Harden can really be beaten much more easily one-on-one in the perimeter. But Houston is expert at shrinking the floor, especially when two bigs are out there. Just ask the Minnesota Timberwolves, who really only had one good offensive game in their series, and that's a much better offensive team than Utah. Now, of course, Utah is a completely different animal on the defensive end, and I think that even Minnesota, we saw the Spurs last year, have a decent amount of success against Houston, trying trying to play the pick and roll two on two, leaving their big back at the rim. There is no better big in the NBA to execute that system than Rudy Gobert. And, you know, especially to try and maybe take away those Clint Capela alley-oop two on two as well. He's a master at that. The other advantage that the Jazz have is they don't really play anyone who's just that easy of a mark for Harden to get switched onto him. Mitchell, Rubio, I think is fine if he's going to be out there. Royce O'Neal, Jay Crowder, Ingles even, you know, is a little slow for Harden, but, you know, he's not just like someone that, oh, you go one-on-one at him, he's just going to get torched every time. Harden is certainly capable of beating those guys plenty, but the Jazz are not really a switching team, and so I think that's going to be more conventional pick and roll. We saw that Chris Paul, as a mid-range artist, he may have to get back into that game a little bit in this series, and it'll be interesting to see where Houston is going to go in terms of their personnel. Are they going to go with Gerald Green more? Joe Johnson looks like he's probably not going to play much for them going forward here. Didn't play much in the Minnesota series. PJ Tucker, Ariza, those two guys going to hit shots or not? Can they go with Tucker at the five to draw Gobert out of the paint? I don't think he's that much of a threat that they're so worried about it. So I think it's got to be Capela, and Capela is a totally good switch guy too. I do predict that Houston is going to struggle to score a little bit. You know, they really, Golden State is the team that I think is set up a little bit better to beat Utah. And, you know, you wouldn't think so because they have this great off-dribble shooting ability from Harden, but we've seen him struggle against these more conservative schemes in the playoffs for whatever reason. And so this series to me is going to answer a lot of questions about what Rudy Gobert's impact is against one of these great modern offenses. And then where James Harden is at now as a player too. He had some stinkers against Minnesota. He had obviously some massive games. A lot, of course, will come down to the three-pointers for Houston, but I ultimately think it'll be a hard-fought five-game series as well. I think Houston is going to be just too good, but it wouldn't shock me if we see it go a little bit longer than that. Seven would be a pretty big surprise to me, though, but we'll see. Maybe Gobert is just that good. I can't wait to find out.
One injury note, we talked about the questions with Ricky Rubio. It sounds like Luke Richard and Bob Mute is going to be evaluated next week. We're recording this on Friday night, of course, so he could be back for a portion of the series, but we don't have a real timeline there. If he's on the floor, that gives that Houston even more defense to put against Utah.
Let's talk a little bit about Pel's Warriors now. Steph Curry, in a little bit of an upset and perhaps subterfuge, went through a couple of full practices just recently. He played 5-on-5 full contact, I believe, in both of those practices. He is considered questionable for tomorrow, game one against the Pels at 7:30 p.m. It does not seem like the Warriors to rush him back at all. But certainly Curry, there's no person in the NBA who changes defensive schemes more than he does. So just having that be in the mix certainly is useful from a preparation standpoint. And if he doesn't play, I give the Pels a reasonable chance to win games in the series. The Warriors may also struggle to reintegrate him. He probably will also be on a minutes limit to start, just to make sure that knee is not going to swell up too much after games. You know, I think he's probably going to be playing 20-25 minutes a game at the start of this series. But if he's back at all, I don't see the Warriors losing home games in this series. He could probably compromise their defense a little bit, which has been pretty good with although they've been playing the Spurs, so there's really very little you can take from that. So I think my prediction, since it is my term, I will go with the Golden State Warriors in five games, but certainly a lot of variability there depending on what Curry's level of health is. But he is looking like he's on track to come back earlier. And then the schedule for this series, Danny, is interesting because there's that big break in the series between Tuesday and then over the weekend when they're in New Orleans. Everyone thought, oh, they're going to give him another week and just come back then. But it doesn't seem to be trending that way.
It doesn't seem to be. Something else that's super important to note: A, Curry came off the bench his first game back last time against Portland. That was actually the game where he set the overtime scoring record as the Warriors won. I wouldn't be surprised if it's something similar, that he comes off the bench, plays about 20 minutes, and he'll be below 100% whatever he plays in this series. That's not a surprise. I mean, one of the big questions is going to be, what is he at after this series should the Warriors advance?
And part of why it'll be important for them to win this series quickly and get him some more rest to get up to 100%.
Right, and it will also be important to a point for them to root for Utah to make that a longer series, to kind of give them an extended break in that sort of a way. And what I think is the central point in this series, and this is a big, big change from last time for New Orleans. They deserve praise for how thoroughly they eviscerated Portland. New Orleans has to figure out a way to defend Kevin Durant, and the Warriors have to figure out a way to defend Anthony Davis. And I think the Warriors have more more options and superior options at that specific challenge than the Pelicans do with Durant.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. And I think the Warriors, they have some mismatched talent. They don't have enough shooting, but I think they still have more talent than this Pelicans team. They got it together to some degree against San Antonio, though they also had some ugly stretches in that series. The Pels finished the season really well. Their offense looked great with Mirotić out there. I don't think that they have any answers for Kevin Durant, who had 41 against them in that game that the Pels won as part of their playoff push in April. Worth noting that the Warriors in their game after that lost by 40 at Utah, so they weren't exactly engaged, shall we say, at that point in the process. But I think that we are, because the Pels had such a good matchup against Portland, I think it's really, we're kind of overreading them in our minds right now. You know, I mean, if they win a 7-game series against Portland, you know, are people feeling like, oh, they can really give the Warriors problems? You know, I'm not really sure about that. So I think I will go with the 5 games. That's what I said. So, all right, let's do a quick read and we'll talk about the rest of the games that happened since we were last on. And that read will be from Audible. I have been an Audible subscriber since 2005. And I used to download the books onto my iPod. Once you get on your phone, it's much, much easier now to use it. You can even listen at a faster speed as well, if you're that kind of person who listens to our podcast on a faster speed. And I've really been enjoying it for sports books lately. I read Loose Balls, the great book about the ABA, which is just, that's just an unbelievable book that any basketball fan should read, by Terry Pluto. Just finished up Jonathan Abrams, 2 books by him. The book about, I think it's called Boys to Men, about the preps to pros era, which may be returning soon enough to the NBA. I also read his oral history of The Wire, which was fantastic. But those kind of books are just great to get a little bit of an escape from the day-to-day of the NBA podcast that I know you guys are listening to. The way it works is that as an Audible member, you get a credit every month for any audiobook. And it doesn't matter what the price of that book is, you can get any book once a month. And if you don't use your credit that month, they're not going to take it away from you. They'll roll over to the next month. And if you didn't like your audiobook, just exchange it for another one. No questions asked. And your books are yours to keep. Or you can share the account. Actually, my fiance and I do that through Amazon. They also, you can set it up with WhisperSync, where if you own a book on Kindle, you can seamlessly switch back and forth from your last point on Audible to your last point in Kindle. It's really fantastic if you're in the car. You're just, instead of just sitting there in the car in your garage, almost getting carbon monoxide poisoning because you're just so into the book, you can go inside and just keep reading it on your Kindle. The way to get started with them, you can get a 30-day trial. Your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/capspace, or you can text our code capspace to the number 500-500. That's audible, audible.com/capspace, or text capspace to 500-500. Let them know with that capspace code that you came from us. So let's run through the rest of the day's games. Not as much intrigue here. Probably the way to go is with Toronto finally closing out a first-round series in less than 7 games. The Wiz got a huge blow finding out that Otto Porter, who had been limited in the series with both an ankle injury, a calf injury that he suffered towards the end of the regular season, had to have a small procedure to reduce swelling in a contusion that he had suffered. And really, once again, this was about transition. The Wizards surged out, had a 10-point lead in the first quarter because they had 12 first quarter fast break points. And then they finished the game with 18 fast break points. Raps only gave up 6 more. And in the half court, the Wizards just a little bit too limited, didn't, especially without the spacing that Porter provided. Kelly Oubre, his replacement, 3 points, 1 of 7, he struggled. And Toronto got a big boost to their bench, Danny, with the return of one Fred VanVleet.
Yeah, one of the biggest runs that Toronto went on, and the one that really kind of helped establish where this game was going, was at the beginning of the fourth quarter, when not only was DeMar DeRozan out, Kyle Lowry was out too. And so it was an all bench lineup for the Raptors that went on a big run. VanVleet was a part of that, fighting on defense, helping create shots for his teammates. I thought he made a big difference. A couple of big baskets from Pascal Siakam, who was active defensively, yeah, as he
also
always
had
is.
3 offensive rebounds in the fourth quarter, Siakam did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was actually how the game really sealed. Toronto was missing some shots in their half-court offense, but they were getting offensive rebounds. They actually took a lot of the air out of the ball. I think it was about a minute and a half or something like that, where they were just kept on getting offensive rebounds. But just to put a brighter line on your point, Washington, 78 offensive rating in the half court, 186 offensive rating in transition. But 10% more of their plays came in the half court than Toronto, and Toronto actually ran a lot in this game, partially because they were getting opportunities.
Their bench really pushes the pace. Van Vliet being in there really helped that a lot.
And DeLon Wright having four steals really helped that too. So you get a lot that way. And so it's hard for the Wizards to sustain. They just don't have, that's not the kind of talent they have. I thought Beal had a pretty good game overall. He did some nice things early, in particular, ended with 32 points, 10 to 22 from the field, 6 to 6 from the line. He did have six turnovers, that's worth mentioning. But the Wizards just don't have enough creation. They don't have enough conversion. And Oubre, you know, disappointed in this game. If he hits a couple more of those shots, maybe this looks different. But this series had basically that feel the whole way through.
Yeah, and the games when the Wiz were able to run, they won. Otherwise, they weren't. And it was a 29-14 fourth quarter for Toronto that did it. I mentioned the fact that they're able to retrieve all those loose balls in the fourth, you know, with some of their fresher bench players. But Kyle Lowry, who only played 32 minutes in this game, I thought he looked so much fresher, especially when he came in the fourth. He just got a couple of massive loose balls late. He just shot out of a cannon, just took it away from Washington players that he had no business getting to. He also led Toronto with 24 points, only 17 shooting possessions. Great efficiency from Lowry, also six assists, offsetting a rough night from DeRozan. They were actually minus six when he was in the game. He only had 16 points on 20 shooting possessions, so it wasn't his best game. The three-pointer, which had so buoyed him in this series, he went back to earth on that a little bit with 0 for 4. But, Wright and Van Vliet had two of the best 2 for 6 and 2 for 7 from the field games that you'll ever see. They really hounded defensively, and the Raps were able to go to more of those three-guard lineups because Washington is so limited at the wing position, and I thought that was huge as well.
One other thing, just because I don't think we've really talked about it in this series, I felt Valanciunas outplayed Gortat pretty significantly. I mean, Gortat did provide value as a screener, but Valanciunas was able to eat more than I expected, was also able to stay on the floor more than I expected. So he averaged 13.5 points and 9.3 rebounds. Not the greatest defender in a lot of circumstances, but I thought Valanciunas had a good series.
Yeah, and again, it's a series where he could be okay. There are a few times where John Wall and Gortat were able to get the pick and roll chemistry going and beat Valanciunas, but largely the Raps were able to keep Washington off the three-point line. Beal was 6 of 10, rest of team 2 of 12 from downtown in this game, and Beal and Wall took 15 of their 22 three-point attempts. So you see that they didn't have the spot-up shooting out there, and those guys weren't getting shots. You know, that's where they really missed Porter to a large degree. And then Valanciunas with 6 offensive rebounds. Pirtle had 3 offensive rebounds. They overall as a team, 34% offensive rebounds in this game. That was pretty big. And so Toronto finally is moving on. They took care of business reasonably well in this series. You know, it would have been nice if they could have won game 3, I think it was, when they were looking pretty good, looked on the road to a sweep that didn't end up happening. But they ultimately, especially getting Van Vliet back, who, you know, he said he doesn't have 100% range of motion in his shoulder. I think there's a chance of re-injury. You know, they're saying over the next 4 to 6 weeks. So he could be subject to another tweak of that at any time. But he was huge. The bench was huge. And for Washington, you know, this is what they do, I guess. They lose in the first round. They lose in the second round. They're kind of competitive, but not that competitive, and never really make you think like they're about to win the series. And so, I guess they bring back this next team. We're going to start getting into offseason previews probably next week. So we'll have a lot more to say about them. We'll have a lot more to say about OKC, obviously, at that point. And so Toronto now awaits the winner of the Cavaliers and Pacers. Pacers just destroyed Cleveland. And this was the Cleveland defense that I was expecting to see a lot more of in this series.
And the reason why we saw that Cleveland defense is because Indiana actually forced the issue. They pushed the ball both in transition and then just attacked a little bit earlier in the clock. Darren Collison played a much better game, and Victor Oladipo's shot was falling. He has been very inconsistent on his threes, hit 6 of 9 in game 1 and has basically not hit many between then and now. 6 of 8 from 3, so Oladipo had 28 points. Did end up getting that triple-double partially because he stayed in the fourth quarter, which I do not agree with. That game was very well settled. And another big question with this is there were a couple of, you know, injuries that are at least like Cavs players that got into stuff during this game, and we'll have to see how that affects game 7. Kevin Love got Miles Turner's left elbow, hit him right in the head, and I was concerned about a concussion. concussion. He ended up coming back in the game. And then LeBron got popped by Thaddeus Young, and he had a cut right above his eye. That one I don't think is as significant. But how that affects, if it affects anything, and then George Hill missed this game yet again due to his back issue.
Yeah, he tried to warm up, just really could not go. And I mean, his loss has been pretty massive. Had to play Jose Calderon. Jose Calderon is a replacement level NBA player right now. And he had one good game in the series, but he's reverted back at this point. I don't think he even had a shot attempt in this game. And going back to your point on the transition, you could even see, but I think it was also just to be more aggressive from Collison. And it was interesting, the Pacers, we don't really know what the reason was. We're very fast paced early in the season and then slowed down to one of the slowest paces in the league as the season wore on. And they were playing that way as well. We lamented at the end of game five that they were not pushing the ball. And you could tell there were even a couple of times where they would get a rebound and kind of Oladipo would take a couple of steps to just kind of jog it up. And all of a sudden he'd be like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to push it. And he would just shift into high gear. And this Cleveland transition D is so bad that, you know, they have no one to protect the rim and they're slow. And so especially if you can catch them when the defense isn't set and loaded towards you, you can just get right to the basket or get wide open threes. Their communication in a scramble situation is very poor as well. And here's the carnage for the numbers here for Indiana. Overall in transition, they ran 21% of the time. That's really good. That's 91st percentile, 21% of their possession. When they ran, they averaged a 1.9 points per possession. That is just absolutely ridiculous. That's basically a bucket every single time they pushed the ball. And off a live rebound, 2.2 points per possession. A lot of that was Oladipo pushing and then just walking in to three-pointers when the defense would just back off. Oladipo was unbelievable. Had his best game since game one. Shot it extremely well with 6 of 8 from downtown East. He's been so feast or famine for three in the series. And then Collison was the other guy who I thought was so much better. 15 points, 3 of 4 from three for him as a 40% three-point shooter. And Lance gave them a lot of offense early before the Pacers started blowing it out. He missed a bunch of shots late, but it didn't matter. He had 6 assists. It was really an outstanding game for pretty much everyone. Sabonis was totally unstoppable again around the rim as the role man. He was plus 28. Miles Turner was plus 20. They played some together. Both those guys they got production from. And then Cleveland really had a bunch of issues in this game, but they didn't get the same LeBron James that they got in game five in particular as far as trying to get to the rim.
Yeah, for those who remember, in game five, 9 of LeBron's 11 shots in the first half were in the restricted area, and it might have even been 11 to 12. I mean, it was a ridiculous number. And he was just settling for jump shots a lot, and it was often against centers. He was taking that kind of left end, elbow extended, above the break three, and, you know, he ended up 3 of 6 from long range. I think it was, you know, 1 of 4, something like that, earlier in the game. And he had just shown this level of domination. Basically, no one on the Pacers could guard him in game five. And I don't think, other than loading up and putting more guys on his side, that Indiana changed anything tactically to take LeBron out of that. Not many teams can. He just, for whatever reason, wasn't in that frame of mind, wasn't in that, maybe it's fatigue, something else, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like Cleveland scored well again in this series. You know, they had 98 offensive rating. Indiana had a 136 offensive rating in this game, which is absolutely insane, of course. And James got even less help than usual. You know, Rodney Hood ended up with 12 points, hit a few mid-rangers, but he was ultimately negative 27. One of the things that's been surprising for me is how few threes Hood has taken. He took a lot of threes off the dribble in Utah. I thought he could add that. He's not really been doing that much at all. J.R. Smith took some tough threes, 3 of 8, you know, not enough to kill Cleveland. Kevin Love continues to struggle, only 24 minutes. He was below 10 points again, 0 offensive rebounds. Tristan Thompson got in when Love got smacked in the face. He was negative 16 in 14 minutes. Wasn't really able to provide much. He only had 2 offensive rebounds. And he, I don't know if he's fallen off as a switch defender, probably has, but he had one play where Oladipo just totally burned him for a three at the end of the quarter. There were some great dunks in this series or in this game as well. LeBron on Sabonis, then Sabonis kind of got him back, and then Oladipo just broke J.R. Smith's ankles, went in for a dunk that was kind of the side of LeBron. He almost just completely ended LeBron like 2 minutes before that in the third quarter, but a two-hander just hit the back rim. That would have been unbelievable. But I mean, not much else to say here. You know, I think this game seven now, much like the other one, which we'll get to, we'll talk about Thursday night's game shortly after this. But while I would never, almost under any circumstances, favor a road team in a game seven, unless there was just like some injury issue and the guy was back and he wasn't there earlier in the series or something like that, I would give both of these road teams a much higher chance than the typical 80% home winning rate in these game seven.
I would too. Probably something around, so for Cleveland, I'd say I probably have it about a 65% chance for them. And then for the game we're talking about later, maybe like 60% for the Celtics. One thing, partially because I still have that game on my mind, I wanted to make this point when we were talking about OKC Utah, but I just want to make it so it's on the podcast. Something else that probably contributed to these teams being so gassed at the end, we always talk about Denver's elevation. Utah is the other team that gets a material advantage because it's the second highest elevation in the league. And considering the high intensity of those minutes, it wouldn't surprise me if they just got incredibly gassed with that helping fuel that fatigue.
Yeah, that's a reasonable one. I've always wondered whether the road team between games 3 and 4 or 1 and 2, whatever it is, when you spend more time there or play one game there, if you get more acclimated or not in the second game. I'd be interested to look at that performance. Nothing really that Cleveland did against Oladipo worked in this game. I mean, I think a lot of it is just going to come down to how well does Oladipo play and does he hit his three-pointers? If he shoots like this, there's nothing that Cleveland can do to stop him. And then what kind of LeBron are we going to see? You know, if LeBron doesn't score at least 35 points, I mean, he might even have to score 40 for them to win this game, you think. But quick turnaround, nobody played that many minutes in this one, though. It's not a very far of a flight, so you expect guys to be pretty well rested for this game seven. I can't wait to see that. We're going to talk Milwaukee Boston, but first we wanted to try something a little bit new here. I consider myself very lucky, I know that Danny does as well, to be able to have this podcast that's independent, and we've been looking at some ways to try to use this podcast to give back to our community, our country, our world, really. And I talked to Danny about it, and he turned me on to Team Rubicon, which he has been donating to for quite some time.
I started donating to Team Rubicon back in 2012, and for me, charity is a very personal thing. I try to find something that really does move me and go in that direction. And Team Rubicon, what reached out to me was the combination of a great idea and really amazing execution of it. And so what Team Rubicon does is they take the idea that military veterans have this amazing set of skills that they have developed during their time in the armed forces, and they realized it's a really natural fit for disaster response, because a lot of times this situations are similar. And so what Team Rubicon does is it connects military veterans with first responders, medical professionals, the people that are dealing with these catastrophes, and makes the situation better. It can be in a lot of different ways, whether it's, you know, helping rebuild or deal with floodwaters or emergency, you know, medical care, and lots of different things that can happen. And another reason why I like it, beyond the support for veterans, and I think it's a great idea, is that disasters can strike anywhere. This is not a partisan thing. This is not a political element of it. They help everybody, and they've done great work from Hurricane Harvey, Maria in Puerto Rico, a really impressive job. I've loved being a donor for them has been a fulfilling experience. So when Nate and I talked about this, that was my first suggestion.
Yeah, and we'll tell you more about them in future times, but you know, we love great stats on the show. They provided over $7.2 million and deployed 4,450 volunteers in 2017 alone. Since they began in 2010, they've done over 250 disaster response operations, and 80% of your money goes directly to their operations on the ground. I know some charities have gotten a little bit of bad press because they're not putting as much of your money towards actually helping people, and there's more administrative costs. That's not the case for Team Rubicon. So if you want to learn more about them, if you want to donate to them as we do, go to teamrubiconusa.org/capspace, easy to remember, capspace, of course, or you could text capspace to the 5-digit number 87872. So teamrubiconusa.org/capspace, or text capspace to 87872 to learn more about them or to make a donation. So we'll catch up on yesterday's action now, with the Bucks finishing off the Celtics. It wasn't that close late.
I will mention finish them off in game six, not finish off the series.
That's what I meant. Yeah, finish it off before it was too close at the end is what I was talking about. So the Bucks had a decent lead. They held Boston to 15 points in the second quarter and 21 in the fourth. 97-86, Milwaukee took it. And I was impressed that the Bucks, I mean, really, I think for the last four games, they've made some mistakes, but they have brought excellent defensive intensity. They held Boston to 10 out of 36 three-point shooting, but a lot of those were pretty contested late clock stuff. And then Milwaukee was able to outscore them 19-11 in the final 7:59, as Boston really was unable to score. It was pretty close by that point. Boston
came back, and then Milwaukee was able to break out of contact again. Giannis led all scorers with 31. He was 13 to 23 from the field. And what were some of the keys to this win for the Bucks? To you, Danny?
Thonmaker started the game. I think that was really important. He did get five fouls. He was in foul trouble for stretches of this, but his you talked about defensive intensity. I think that was really important. Chris Middleton only took 8 shots. He still looks great offensively in this series. It was weird that he didn't get that many opportunities. And Terry Rozier started out hot. I mean, a big part of the reason that Boston held a 24-22 lead in a honestly pretty gross first quarter was Rozier going 4 of 6 from the field, 3 of 4 from three. After that 3 of 4 in the first quarter, he was 1 of 8 from three in the rest of the game.
Another huge stat in this one, Boston was forced into taking 21% of their shots with under 4 on the shot clock due to the Bucks' intensity, some of their switching, but just their inability to really create separation. 10 of those 16 shots were threes. I mean, those are really, we're talking desperation threes at that point. And then Boston had to take a further 14 shots from 7 to 4 on the shot clock. So you're taking basically as Boston 40% of your field goal attempts with under 7 on the shot clock. And it's just very, very difficult to be efficient that way. The pace of this game was glacial. As a result, Boston really was not able to get out and transition much. The Bucks were to some degree. Those were some key points as well. And it seemed like in the first half, really throughout most of this game, it was just like it had been in game 5, just an absolute war between these teams. Any bucket felt like, you know, just a massive body blow to the other team. Mistakes just were absolutely crushing because they were forcing the teams into such difficult shots most of the time. And I liked that Prunty basically went with only Giannis or Thon at center, except when he was forced in the second half into using Zeller just a little bit. And this Bucks team has really been difficult to score. Eric Bledsoe has gotten a lot of crap for some of his gambling, some of his falling asleep defensively, but I thought that overall his help defense was more a positive than a negative in this game. He really just, when he's locked in, he covers so much ground, and he can help off of guys, just materialize in the lane with that length, plays with a lot of force when he goes after that, got a couple of steals. He was just even forcing a guy to pick up his dribble on a drive just a little bit earlier than he wanted to. Thon was flying around. I mean, he absolutely, there was one play, the one where he actually ended up committing a 3-shot foul, but was still emblematic of his level of activity. There was a driving kick, they threw it to the corner, and it was, Jabari Parker was the guy on the block closest to the corner, and he just never moved. And so Thon is like, oh, you're not going to move? I'll rotate out there. And he almost got there, but then ended up committing that foul. But his, you know, his offense wasn't there. The shots weren't falling for him from three-point range. But just as a defensive player, he just cleaned up so many messes in this game with his activity, and then he proved pretty difficult to score on as a switch guy.
Another impactful defensive player for Milwaukee, Tony Snell. I thought he did a nice job in this game. Also hit a couple shots, 2 of 6 from three. Those were all of his shots in the game. He didn't take any twos, and the Bucks look more balanced, more competitive defensively when he's out there instead of your favorite pass first point guard, Malcolm Brogdon.
Yeah, Brogdon still has to take 3 dribbles before he can do anything at all, even shoot sometimes, although he did have a pretty big three-pointer. Again, we joked that I think he had made 5 three-pointers in the series, and we could remember at least 3 of them. They're all in the last 5 minutes of the game, 2 of them in the last minute to either tie or take the lead. For Boston, really nobody could get it going. Rozier ended up 4 of 12 from 3, wasn't really getting great looks. Only 18 assists for Boston is not where they wanted to be. They shot 37% from the field, 28% from three. Didn't get to the foul line especially much. I thought that Giannis was, despite the fact that he sprained his left ankle, in addition to that right ankle that he keeps spraining, was able to be much more effective offensively. He hit a couple of mid-rangers, which I thought were big, but maybe due to the extra spacing, he was able to get to the rim more. I thought he was able to solve Ojale, and Ojale only had 1 shot attempt in 22 minutes. And so Stevens had some really good defensive lineups, really was not able to find the offensive lineups. And then Marcus Smart, negative 14 in this one, gave a lot of effort, but took some pretty bad threes, which you don't want to do with some big ass wrap on your hand. But Marcus Smart, never that judicious. And it's getting to the point now where for Stevens, they just can't score enough any longer, that maybe he can't keep his best defensive units on the floor. But then they don't really have any great offensive units either out there.
Yeah, going to Marcus Morris doesn't really solve all their problems on that end. And Shane Larkin doesn't have much of a place to be at all in this series anymore either.
Yeah, he's another guy who provides some places to attack for Milwaukee. Milwaukee. I also thought that Jabari Parker didn't have an unbelievable statistical game, although he might have had like a per minute high in his career with 9 defensive rebounds in 26 minutes. He still competed enough defensively, missed a couple of rotations, but he wasn't just a complete sieve. They weren't just destroying him when he was out there. He was holding up more. He was plus 11 in his 26 minutes. Bledsoe still couldn't get much going offensively, but again, I thought he was pretty good on D. So the Bucks got just enough defensively in this one, or just enough offensively, and their defense just, it looks so hard for Boston to score. And this game 7 is just going to be like absolutely back to the Stone Age in terms of the offense. I think the Bucks are going to struggle to score a lot more in Boston. The intensity is going to be off the charts. These teams are going to be ready to kill each other. There's going to be so much length and athleticism on the floor. And like I said, I give Milwaukee a pretty damn good chance for your typical road team in a game 7 in the series. I'd say, you know, 40% chance they have of winning this one. Anything else you wanted to say on this game before we wrap up?
Well, we're going to do it for the Twitter NBA yeah. show, unless it gets to an insurmountable 6-point lead for one of the two teams. Then maybe we'll hop over to Oracle in time for the beginning of that game. But it'll be a lot of fun. The only other thing I want to mention, not necessarily about this game 7, but promote, I recorded and edited and released Real Gym Radio for this week all on Friday. It is with Derek Bodner of The Athletic Philadelphia on the Sixers season, on where it's going. He also talks about which team he thinks would be better for the Sixers in terms of winning game 7, which we disagreed on that, which is always fun. And it's a good conversation. Very different from the kind of stuff we do here, but I think people will enjoy it. Oh, also my offseason preview for the Charlotte Hornets came out. For those who don't want the upliftingness of the Sixers, you can read about the Hornets' limited flexibility and trading Kemba Walker.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many of these are just going to be completely depressing. Minnesota, you already did Detroit too, right?
I wrote it. It hasn't come out yet.
Portland, I'm sure you're going to be doing too. I mean, you're really just getting to like the absolute dregs of the league in terms of cap space.
No, but it's like, it's more than half the league in terms of teams that, I mean, it's not like the Knicks preview is going to be much sunnier. I mean, there are all these teams because they're, you know, like 9 teams, I think, is the estimate that I'm using right now that I would expect to use cap space this year.
Oh, you know what? We have some news.
Oh, that's right. That's a thing that still happens.
Yeah. All right. Let's start here. San Antonio, Pau Gasol said he plans to be back next season. My response to that is no shit. He's owed another $23.5 million over the next
that
two
was
years.
Actually his first answer. I was in the room when that happened. And he's like, I'm under contract for, and he didn't say the exact number, but he's like, I'm under contract for next year, so I'll be here. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
It was a great answer.
Basically, players do not retire when they have guaranteed money that much. I mean, we saw Tim Duncan leave $6 million. He didn't leave $6 million on the table. They actually just waived him and stretched him before he retired. KG ended up getting all of his $8 million when he kind of retired before the season. More interesting news. We had talked about Mike Budenholzer and Atlanta agreeing to part ways. It turns out that Bud will get all of his money. And it was reported by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that he was effectively fired. He did not want to resign due to that money. However, he retains the offset clause in his contract. So wherever he signs now, that will be offset. But now I think that opens up more destinations to him, because if he doesn't make as much as he's going to make in Atlanta, then Atlanta just covers the difference. But it seemed like it made more sense for Atlanta just to move on from him now, because then maybe they could lose out on their next selection for a coach as well. If they didn't do this now, they couldn't start interviewing on their own. And some of the names that have been floated in Atlanta, all kind of assistant types, young guys coming in, more inexpensive, and we'll see where Bud in fact ends up. Bud will still have plenty of incentive to get as much money as he can, because presumably he only had 2 years left on his contract. His new contract will go beyond that. In Denver, Mason Plumlee will have surgery for a core muscle injury. That sounds like maybe a sports hernia. He's supposed to be able to return to basketball activities in the summer. So that's usually, sports hernia surgery is usually like 6 to 8 weeks. So it sounds like probably what this is teammate Jamal Murray had a similar procedure last year. And then Memphis, in a total non-surprise, has brought in JB Bickerstaff on a permanent basis.
Per Woj, it's a 3-year contract to be their head coach. And I mean, anytime you can bring back somebody who stewarded you to just an absolutely thrilling season like the Memphis Grizzlies did, And I'm not saying win-loss record should be any part of this for J.B. Bickerstaff, but I've been in, you know, because he was the interim head coach for the Rockets back when they had that super weird series for the Warriors a couple of years ago when the wheels totally went off the wagon. I've never really seen too much from Bickerstaff. It does seem like their players do like him, but it's weird because he's not a retread because he's never had a head job before, but I've just never really seen much in terms of what he runs or anything to be particularly inspired by it. But I'm guessing he fit within Para's financial constraints.
Yes, and he's already been there. He was at least a good soldier during the tank. I mean, I guess Para was just happy that they didn't lose by 65 to the Hornets instead of 61 and decided to bring him back in. But yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, the personnel was certainly limited here. The veterans there seem to like him. He's not going to be expensive. But if you wanted to tell me like one thing other than in theory relating to some players that he does well as a coach or what he stands for other than just kind of your usual smash mouth cliches, I would be hard pressed to come up with anything there. So I think if we had to do coach rankings, he would be very much towards the bottom of the league. We'll see how he does next year. You know, with a real team, he's been in some weird situations. Maybe he'll look better, but I haven't seen anything too particularly encouraged there. Okay, that'll do it for today. Please don't forget about Team Rubicon, by the way. TeamRubiconUSA.org/capspace is that URL to learn more about that charity, which we are supporting here. And our schedule, we will be back on Sunday night with a pair of Game 7s. We'll be in the books by that time. Looking forward to discussing those. Till then.